Welcome to Claim Your Confidence, a podcast that will introduce you to the most powerful people in the world. No matter what obstacles you face, Claim Your Confidence will inspire and motivate you to go after the life you want. Are you ready to claim your confidence?
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Claim Your Confidence. I'm Lydia Finette, and I am so excited to be sitting in warm, cozy newsstand studios on this freezing, raining day in New York City. Across from me is a woman who I truly think if you were sitting anywhere outside of New York City thinking about how you wanted a career in fashion, she might have the job that is the pinnacle of every fashion lover's dream, and that is the president of Bergdorf Goodman. Darcy Penick, welcome to Claim Your Confidence.
Thank you. I could not be more happy to be here with you. And you look like human sunshine. Lydia is literally wearing a yellow sunshine dress, which really helps to offset the day.
Yeah, I know. I was really needing to model more sunshine. We just came back from a long family vacation in the sun. And so I feel like I'm not ready to let it go yet. But New York is trying to dissuade me of that notion literally at every turn. So Darcy, I know in addition to being the president of Bergdorf Goodman, you also have an additional role as the head of technology and product for Neiman Marcus Group. And we are going to dive into that entire program and that entire position. But I want to start at the very beginning. Who was Darcy when she was little? Because Darcy, when you meet her now, is a supremely confident, beautiful, striking, confident person. So was that who you were as a child?
I think so. That's the really honest answer. I've always loved being around people. I like bringing joy. I feel like that's kind of been part of who I am for a really long time. I'm sort of the skip down the hallway kid. So I think I kind of still am the skip down the hallway adult.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that can be possible. Did you have any siblings growing up?
I do. I have a sister and I guess Irish twins, the right way to describe that. So we're only 13 months apart.
Wow.
Really close in age. I'm the younger of the two.
Okay. How do your parents explain that? I always wonder when they're so close in age, do you look similar? Are you like sort of doing the same things? Are you grouped together as children?
If we were on this podcast together, you'd have a hard time hearing the difference in our voices, but we look different, dress different, and get along really well, which I think is very lucky. I think that can cut one of two ways when you're that close in age.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes watch my children and I'm one of four kids and I think about all the arguments you have over the most ridiculous things. And in many ways, how that shapes you for the rest of your life, because
100%.
You can argue with so many different people as a result of that relationship, or you can have really good, cozy relationships as well, either way, depending on who your siblings are and how that's going.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
Originally in St. Louis.
St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah.
In the middle of the country.
Put your fingers straight in the middle on the map and you really land there. It works out nicely.
What did you do when you were little? Like, what was your thing that you liked to do?
I had lots of things. I loved sports and ballet. So I did a lot of dancing, got into sports fairly early, probably the fourth grade. I loved doing things that were collaborative and team oriented. That was sort of a big theme for me starting relatively early.
Which is good because you oversee a lot of people in your life.
Yes, team has worked out nicely for me in that respect. Yeah.
I do always think about how important team sports are for children, because it is one of those things when you see how to lose or how to win. It's something I read an entire chapter in my book about losing constantly as a child on a team, on three teams, actually, for 4 years, to be honest. But we can go back to the another time. But I do really think that team sports help in so many ways, especially as you get older, understanding how to grow through things, how to understand disappointment, what it looks like to be disappointed in a group setting, because all of those things ultimately become part of a career in many ways.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I've always found hard to hire for on a team, but something that I look for, is this orientation towards refusing to lose. And I think there's a lot of that you get out of sports. And that doesn't mean you don't lose.
Yes.
It's having this sort of no matter what, I'm going to fight and play.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to refuse to lose. And so I think for me, that was a big part of that early orientation for me. That's probably one of the pieces that's carried into my adult life or my work life specifically very differently.
I feel like this should be a hashtag, refuse to lose. I'm starting it now. I'm putting a stake in the sand, refuse to lose.
I mean, admittedly, I think I really stole that from a prior boss who planted that seed for me about the idea of hiring for that. Because when we started looking at talent that we felt like you wanted to be kind of in the boat rowing with mm-hmm. and sort of in high stakes moments? Who are the people that you feel like are going to operate that way? And those tend to be the people that you want to work with.
Yeah, they're like plugging the boat, duct tapes totally. Out. Everyone's in it together. Exactly. It's true. That is such a great point when you think about hiring. It is the person who's like, I'm with you through it, through the thick and the thin. And no matter what happens, like we're going to circle the wagons and go yeah. for it.
There's a camaraderie to it too, which I think is one of the reasons I loved being on teams as a child and today love being on a team too, is a lot of that we're in it together and sort of working for the same end goal.
So you left St. Louis when?
For college. Yeah.
And before you left for college, was fashion on your radar? Because that is your career. I mean, you look at the career and it's pretty much a stepping stone through all the major fashion houses and sort of major places that you would ever want to work. But was that something that, were you reading Vogue in your bed at night?
I was. And I think looking back, I don't think I appreciated that it was something I enjoyed as much as I did. There was always, by the way, I'm a terrible artist. So that's an important preface to what I'm about to say. But I would oftentimes be tracing Vogue or Bazaar, different magazines where I would be sort of tracing pictures and then coloring them in. So I feel like dabbled maybe is the right word. It wasn't like I had high exposure growing up in St. Louis to runway shows or anything like that. And I think in the pre-internet days,
no one really did.
It wasn't really on my radar to the same degree. I think by the time I got to college, I started saying things like, I think I might enjoy working in that industry, and really studied something totally different. So it actually on paper didn't look like that was going to make sense.
That wasn't what you thought you were going to do. And where did Absolutely. You end up in college?
I went to Wellesley, which is just outside of Boston.
So you came to the Northeast, and was that kind of how New York got onto your radar, or were you always going to move into New York?
So I remember coming on a high school trip to New York. It was a theater trip. I did a little bit of theater, sort of like another fun extracurricular. I really loved extracurricular activities. Yeah. Maybe the takeaway from some of this too.
I dare say, I think this is why we're friends. Like everything so you've said rings so true to my heart. So yes.
I like 1,000 activities if it involves lots of other people that I get to engage with.
Yeah.
So I had come to New York and remember thinking even in high school, oh, I'll probably live here, but with zero context of what that actually meant or why. And then going to school in Boston, I think there tends to be a lot of people that are New Yorkers that end up there. And so lots of my friends were from here. It just ended up being kind of a natural part of my life. Although I didn't actually move here right after school. I had a couple of stops along the way.
So what ultimately brought you here?
I think two things. This industry certainly played a big part in it. I got a job with Neiman Marcus Group. Actually, this is very full circle.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
My very first job out of school, I was recruited at Wellesley to go into Neiman Marcus's training program. So I actually moved to Dallas.
I was going to say, that's a Texas thing. Yeah.
It was an amazing experience. I'm so glad I did it. At the time after that, you went through their training program, they had you go out to the store. So I actually moved to Miami after that and opened a store with them in Miami and was a manager in the store there, which was a different experience.
But did you like it? Because I have always thought it would be really fun to be on the floor at a store as an extrovert. No, you don't look like that was the case.
So this is something that I actually give people advice in their career around a lot right now. But I was always very driven. I know that's going to come as a real surprise to you. One of the things that I realized when I look back early on in my career is that I was in such a race to get to the next position and the next thing. And I believed I was ultimately right that I wanted to be on a more corporate path. And so at the time, it felt like something that was, quote unquote, slowing down my progress for what I really saw as where I wanted to land. When I actually reflect on it today, I have a totally different perspective on it, because the reality was this was managing in a store environment at the time, because I was opening a new Neiman Marcus store in Coral Gables at the time, which is still alive and very well, a great store.
Yeah.
We were teaching what it meant to have a Neiman Marcus culture and a store experience. I was managing commission sales associates that were very motivated to sell, which created a very unique management dynamic. And I was 22, 23 years old and managing a team of people, which if I step back, I wouldn't have had that type of management experience for many years after that at that scale. So I got incredible, valuable lessons out of that. But at the time, I was rushing to get to the next and didn't appreciate it the same way. So it's a funny thing to answer, because I have such a different vantage point on that today. And I got a lot out of it.
Yeah, I feel like, and you said this earlier too, advice for younger people right now, people who are in their 20s and 30s, who are in their jobs, it is all about that next title. It is all about the 30 under 30. And it's sort of, you want to say to people, slow down, because honestly, what you're learning now, those are the bricks that build the house that stays up, right? You can get the job with a big title and not have any idea what you're doing, and you're going to be out of that job in 2 weeks. If you spend the time learning along the way, ultimately, that's going to pay off in spades. And I love the idea that you were managing a store in Miami. I mean, what?
A department within a store, let's be clear.
Oh, a department within a store. Okay.
Yes, I was not at that scale of management.
That feels less impressive. I'm just kidding.
It was the right scale
that is
for me
the right.
At 22. Yeah. Yes, I'm very clear on that. Yeah.
I think I guess Neiman Marcus knows what they're doing, as it turns out.
Well, and one of the things that I have ended up kind of saying to people that I've been advising on careers that operate the same way that I do then is, you know, I'll say, okay, well, what's the difference between what you were doing in May versus October in 2016? And unless that was maybe the year that you graduated from high school or college, most people can't answer that question.
Right.
And like that, those 6 months when you're thinking you're ready for the next thing at the time feel like sort of like the world is going to come to an end if you don't get that next role at the timeline that you want. And so how to sort of teach that? I wish someone had been at least attempting to teach me that at the time.
Yeah, a little bit more senior people being like, just relax. Like,
slow
you will get
down.
There. You have time. I know. I do love it because now in my 40s, I feel like in my 20s, and especially in my 20s, it was always about gunning for the next role. It was always 100%. About that next title. And at the end of the day, now when I look back on my resume, I'm like, who cares? Like, even the job titles sometimes, you just look at them and you're like, that doesn't mean anything outside of the four walls. Learn the skills, because the skills come with you no matter where you go, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how long were you in Miami before, was New York your next stop?
New York was my next stop.
All right. Yeah. And then what brought you to the Big Apple?
Let's keep going with full circle. I actually transferred, Neiman Marcus owns Bergdorf Goodman. That's the reason I have a job on both sides of that today. But I transferred. So my first real buying position was a buyer for Bergdorf's.
Oh my gosh. Was it ever in your idea or mind that being president of Bergdorf Goodman might be the ultimate goal for you? Or was it at that point you were so young, you were just kind of doing the job and looking to be a, I don't know.
I think I'd be lying manager. If I said, like, yeah, I'll probably come back as president was not the sentence I was saying at 25 years old or however old I was when I left there.
It is funny, though. Sometimes I interview people on Claim Your Confidence and they will say to me, oh, no, I knew. I knew exactly what I was going to do. I'm trying to remember who was six years old. Oh, Dana Perino from Fox News. But she literally said to me, I knew I was going to be the press secretary when I was 6 years old. Like I said to my father. And it's amazing because some people do have that vision. I'd never even heard of the auction world until I was in college. I had no idea it existed. So to have thought that I would have a 20 plus decade career in this industry is so interesting. And it's funny to be with someone who's done something in a very similar way in a different industry.
As you say that, it's making me giggle because I remember I was very lucky. My first assistant buyer job at Neiman Marcus in Dallas, I was working for a woman who, if I remember correctly, I think her parents were in the airlines, and so she could sort of fly for free, and she would work it to be able to have me come with her on the trips, which no one got to do, and it was like the most generous and lovely gift, and I would stay with friends and make it work to come. And I remember I was an assistant buyer in contemporary sportswear, and I had been obsessed with Donna Karan and DKNY, and I remember going to my first DKNY appointment, and Donna Karan sat down at my table and was eating off our little shared snack plate. And I just felt like I'd arrived.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So you have these moments that you think back on of like, there are so many lucky things about those experiences. And I think there are people that get really uncomfortable when I talk about luck being part of my experience. And I feel incredibly comfortable with that piece. It's not that I don't believe I would have otherwise been successful in some way, but the fact that I got placed in an office with a buyer who was willing to do that for me and came, I was working hard to probably warrant that to some degree, let's be clear. But some of those things are also just luck and timing and some really beautiful things that I feel super grateful for today.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think on top of that too, and I can say this because I know you, but you're also, as you said, a joiner and a doer. And I was having a conversation with this really charming young woman who's in her early 20s recently. Her father had put us in touch and he's like, she's in New York and I don't know that she's feeling that great about it. And so she was like, can I just talk to you for half an hour? And we ended up talking about those early years in New York. And she was saying, she's like, you know, I work from home because I'm in a remote job. So I'm in my like tiny apartment. We were all there. I'm like, literally, my bed was my room. So like, that was like, I had to roll across my bed to open my closet.
100%.
She was like, yeah, no, that's exactly like my room. I'm like, those are the best places. She's like, doesn't feel like that right now. Nostalgia. Nostalgia is really quite a thing. But I do think, and I said this to her, and this is advice I would give to anyone who's listening, you underestimate the power of the yes in life and the power of the person who jumps forward. I had so many interns over the course of my career, and there are probably 10 that I still remember. And those were the ones who were like, I saw this invitation on your thing, and I know that you're going to go. And if you ever needed anyone, and I was like, I always need a wingman, like come with me, a wingwoman, like amazing. Come with me. And those were the people who did what I did. It was like they took every opportunity in a place like New York. That's when things happen.
1,000%.
Yeah. So the person probably just liked you and was like, come on the plane with me. And now as a result of that, I'm sitting next to Donna Karan while she's eating food off of me. And I love Donna Karan.
This is such a special moment for me.
Such a special moment.
21 years old or however
old. I know. You're like, I can't even eat off of that plate because she's such an icon, you know.
Life changing.
So you had that job. And then what was the next step? You stayed at Bergdorf for how long?
So I actually wasn't at Bergdorf all that long. I think right around 2 years. And at that point, I'd been at Neiman Marcus Group in 3 different roles in my first 5 years in my career. And I actually went to a startup that stopped.
Oh, tell me about that experience, because that was startup culture at that point, right?
It was.
What year is this?
Oh, we're in the aughts.
The aughts, guys. Bring out, get your slip dresses out.
Get
the wardrobe that you're wearing now back out, because none of those clothes, they've all come back. It's so weird. The go-out top with the jeans.
I remember this as a child where my mom would say, I can't wear that again. I wore that trend the first time. And I really didn't understand that statement. And I'm beginning to really internalize that statement.
Yeah. And I don't throw anything away. Everyone's like, you should reel yourself. I'm like, no way. This stuff all comes back.
You're a keeper.
I'm wearing my bootcut jeans from my 20s. No, I'm wearing it all. I'm bringing it all back out.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
My closet would not be in a good state if I had been keeping what's been happening in my closet for the last 25 years. So I really loved product at the time. And so I'd been on this buying track. It was such a fun part of the industry, was really being able to both look at data. I have a love of right brain, left brain. If you let me play on both sides of that, I'm such a happy camper. And it's part of the reason that retail, I think, has stuck for me, is there's so many things about it that allow you, you know, so many people think of it as it's pretty and you pick out product. And the other side of that is there's a P&L and you're running a very real business. And so for me, the balance of those two things, it's a business of art and science. Mm. And that's part of why I really love it. And at the time, I was probably developing more on the art side of that and really loved product development, that piece. And I was approached about a position that was for a company that was trying to say, you know, the contemporary market is for a narrower audience, but it is starting to move towards more youthful dressing for someone in their 30s to 40s. And this was at the time where, you know, jeans, we were going for like as low of a rise as you could possibly get.
Yes.
Yeah, it's super charming to think back on that. But I remember seeing a funny GIF the other day that was of what a 45-year-old looked like in movies that we watched as a child. And they looked 60, right?
Or 80.
You know, sad cardigan sweaters and really kind of depressing haircuts and things that really painted this picture of a 30 or 40-year-old woman as something that really didn't feel particularly youthful or beautiful. And
the Golden Girls were 55. I don't know if you guys have seen that statistic. They were supposed to be 55 years old. So that's horrifying.
I don't plan on looking at like that at 55.
Even at 100, I think I might be. I don't know if I'm going to do those sweaters, even at 100.
I feel really good about that life choice. So in light of that, I felt like it was a really interesting concept to say, how do you take this sort of more youthful dressing, but make it feel appropriate for this 30 to 40-year-old woman? And it was intending on having freestanding stores, and I was getting to do product development and learn from someone really interesting. The company had been working on the concept for maybe a year and a half or 2 years before I joined. I really learned how great severance agreements are, because I was somehow got good enough advice from a friend that I should negotiate that in since it was a startup. Uh-huh. And it truly stopped about 3 months after I started. So it was a fairly short stint.
How long was your severance?
Gosh, I don't
like
remember. I took years off falling. No, I don't recall, but I know that I had another job by the time
it was
the severance was up. So all
also
of that
the
was
odds,
pretty good news.
Jobs falling out of the sky. Such a good time.
100%.
So what did you learn from that startup experience?
I realized that I did love this aspect of getting to sort of have your hands in lots of things. Mm-hmm. And I think because I had been in relatively large scale companies where you were the owner of a smaller business, a buying career tends to have this aspect where you really get to be sort of an entrepreneur in a very safe environment where there are checks and balances and controls, but a lot of freedom and latitude to make decisions. And while I had loved that in a corporate environment, getting exposure to marketing choices, fixturing choices, how we were thinking about building a brand new brand were things that I found really fascinating in the very short time that I was doing that.
And where did you go from there? Was it another tech company?
No, it was not. And that wasn't actually a tech startup. That was really a retail startup that I was working at then. But I went to Saks Fifth Avenue. So actually an incredible woman who is at Saks today had been actually the woman I worked for at Bergdorf. She had moved to Saks and kindly brought me over.
And was that experience everything you wanted it to be? Because at that point, you'd been working for years. You know, this wasn't your first or second job. You had some time and some experience under your belt. Was that where you felt like you were kind of like, okay, now I'm starting a career? Because I definitely feel like at some point, you're like, wait, maybe this isn't just me floating from place to place. Like, maybe this is something I'm going to do.
Whether rational or not, work felt like a very big part of my identity from the start. And I think we talked sports for a second. But I led a lot of things in college. I really liked leading and I really liked sort of putting a lot of energy into the things that I was working on. I think all of that kind of goes together for me. So I would have probably said I was very serious about my career from sort of earlier than that.
From your time in Miami, you were running your department.
I mean, even as an assistant buyer in Dallas, like I think I just took it really seriously and really liked it.
Yeah. How long were you at Saks?
Probably about 5 years.
And what made you leave?
I think a couple of things. I felt ready for the next position.
Yeah, you were moving on. And you were ready to
But truthfully, they were incredible to me. I had such a good experience there. And I felt like they communicated really well that I was sort of next in line for the next thing in terms of a bigger role. And this is a very silly story, but I remember getting a recruiter call that I had to sign an NDA for that said, you know, this is to go be a divisional, which means you're running a category of products, which was sort of the next step after a buyer is to oversee a broader area of the business. And I remember getting a call where I had to sign an NDA and it was for a digital business that was at this divisional level. And in signing the NDA, I remember turning to my partner at home and saying, if this is ShopUp, I totally am going to interview because I thought they were really interesting. So it wasn't.
Okay.
And 3 months later, it was.
And three months later, it was.
That's while I felt like Saks had been taking very good care of me and I was getting good development and experience and got to do lots of interesting things while I was there, it was funny to have said that sentence out loud and then get the phone calls. Maybe some sort of manifesting was going on there.
This feels like Oprah is nodding somewhere. She's like, you've read my book, The Secret. You know how this works.
I got a little wink. Yeah. And so when it was that phone call, it felt like the right thing to do to go ahead and explore it. And part of the reason I found ShopUp interesting, this is now like deeply dating me. So if you have a young audience, this is going to go very poorly where
I don't think so. And I actually, I mean, even more than that, I would love for you to explain when this is, because I do always think it's really interesting when you're thinking about the evolution of these jobs and these careers, that there are so many fundamental changes taking place. Like fashion was such a specific thing for so many years and tech really disrupted it.
It did.
And ShopUp was one of those disruptors.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about what ShopUp was doing that was different and what the landscape of fashion looked like at that point.
If you're giving me space to do this, I'm going to really back up for a second.
Do
make
it.
A really sweet reference from the truly early aughts. Daily Candy?
Yeah. Oh, I remember Daily Candy drops into your inbox.
Yeah. And it was really kind of at the pulse of things happening in, I mean, primarily in New York, but it was really in fashion. It expanded and it was into food and events and a bunch of things going on, but it felt like sort of a purveyor of cool. I don't even know how to describe it.
It was like the edit of everything cool
that
dropped into your inbox. And like if you were in it or on it or had gone to the restaurants, you were doing the right thing.
So when I was living in Dallas, Texas as an assistant buyer and getting those emails, it made me feel sort of at the pulse of what was going on. It's how I learned about ShopUp probably in, I don't know, 2001, 2002, something like that. And I really had watched it since then. I thought it was fascinating. And I think it was 2006 that it was acquired by Amazon. ShopUp is an online retailer in sort of the youthful sort of serving primarily at the time from sort of college to maybe young 30s woman was probably the focus at that point in time with a fashion point of view that wasn't really happening online. And so as this was really early days of online retail, if I talk about sort of when I first discovered it in 2001, Most people, if they were doing online, it sort of looked like they had taken a catalog page and just dropped it directly onto a website. And so it wasn't particularly dynamic or editorial. And so this convergence of those concepts really wasn't happening. And ShopBop started in Madison, Wisconsin. It had a couple of founders who really had some great sort of instincts around what it meant to create more of an experience online and to have photo shoots and things that just weren't happening. And so they really got attention for both getting, I think, distribution and a great set of brands fairly early on, being sort of a resource for fashion for people that, you know, were in Madison, Wisconsin or not necessarily in big cities. And they were getting a lot right in a very intuitive startup way. And so because I remember discovering them at that time and then noticing that they had been purchased by Amazon. And so if you think about 2006 Amazon, most of us probably weren't customers at that point.
No.
So I recalled the acquisition. So that made them interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And by the time they reached out to me, this was 2009. Mm-hmm. So if we recall sort of the negative experience with the economy in the end of 2008.
Do you remember that? Yes.
Practically speaking, in some respects, it felt like a terrible time to be thinking about, you know, switching jobs or doing any of those things. But I felt like not only was it a business that I had been interested in for a while and tracked, I thought it was fascinating that if I were going to learn a digital business, learning it from an Amazon company was a pretty compelling part of that to me.
Yeah.
And made it very much worth exploring. And then when it came to fruition, I think changing jobs for me is a big decision because I usually love the people I'm working with and I'm very engaged in my role and all those things. Yeah. And I remember it was the first time I really remember sort of calling home. I had flown to Madison, Wisconsin for my interview and done this whole thing for the final phase of it. And I remember calling home and being like, so I really am clear I want this. I don't know if I'll get it, but I really want this role and was really just drawn to the culture, the opportunity, and ended up staying with ShopBop Amazon for 9 years.
It's incredible to think that you were there for 9 years because those were such formative years for both ShopBop and Amazon.
Absolutely.
If you could take it down to two things at this point, what do you think you learned from that experience that you took with you? Because was Bergdorf your next step after that?
Yes.
Yes. So then you kind of returned home, if we've gone full circle. What did you take with you from that that has really influenced or helped you or not, that you can think about from either leadership or even just basically what you learned there that you've taken forward into a company that isn't a tech startup? I mean, Bergdorf is a legacy brand.
So two is hard.
Two is hard. 15 to 20.
I'll be okay.
Yeah.
No, I say that because it was a really important chapter for me and learning curve. And I think it feels a lot easier if we break this down to sort of leadership lessons and experience lessons. I'll see what I can do to get it down to two. I think there's probably, now I'm just going to cheat and extend
my
list. Take
as many as you need. Two is stressing you out. I can
really
see it in your face.
Really having a hard time with that. I'll be okay. So on the leadership side, there's probably two things I would point to. One is Amazon has leadership principles. They're published out there publicly. But one of the things that comes with those is it gives you a shared language of what's important to an organization. Mm-hmm. There's something really fascinating about being able to speak a shared language of what we say is valuable. Things like truth seeking and being right a lot and like ideas that sort of say, well, then if I'm supposed to be right a lot, how much do I need to be on top of my game? I need to know the information. I need to be able to articulate that. So these things that became sort of part of your language of what you wanted people to develop and an orientation towards really having deliberate orientation around leadership. I think the deliberate piece of that, I would credit a lot more to a couple of leaders that I just learned a tremendous amount from. But this idea of shared language are probably two of the things from a leadership perspective that were most valuable to me. And so it's how do you teach an organization to really row in the same direction? I think language can actually play a really powerful role, but it has to be embedded into the culture of the organization. And so how do you create those sort of repetitive behaviors that everyone understands it's important to emulate? And so that was a really powerful piece of that experience. And then this idea of a deliberate leadership. I want to work on improving as a leader at X and then saying, I'm going to be methodical about what it means to improve at that. And so that for me, from a leadership perspective, are probably two of the things that were really incredibly powerful for me. I think from a more kind of business or development perspective, I held quite a few different positions there. So I started by leading their buying organization. I don't know what even my title was, but I was running sort of the, let's call it the top half of the P&L. So I was running buying and planning, sort of the financial side of that. are creative and marketing. And so I had a lot more functions under me. That's a crazy learning curve. And I got a lot wrong and figured out how to get quite a bit right as things went along. And then in my last couple of years, I was in the CEO capacity overseeing the business. And so, you know, it's why I sort of look stressed at trying to pick two things, as it was a pretty unusual chapter of a lot of growth for me in my career. And at the same time, the business was growing at a pace that sort of felt like you were holding onto the tail of a rocket. And so there's probably two parts of that business lesson for me. One would be around the idea that taking your seat at the table. So I mentioned when I was in my startup days, all 3 months of them.
All three, all 90 days of your startup days.
I feel like I got an itch around that, was around the idea of sort of getting exposure in your hands in lots of things. And for the size of ShopUp at the time and the seat that I was in, I had, just to steal your language, a seat at the table, sort of in this idea of like, how do you really take that position? I had this opportunity there where the seat was sort of laid out for me. And so it was, you know, if I expressed interest in learning more about marketing online, it was something where I could really get exposure and experience with that. And those types of things were really giving me the opportunity. It felt like it was being handed to me on a silver plate. And if I wanted to put in the work, like sit in and spend more time on things, that was letting me grow my career. And so that was a really unique and special part of that experience. And then the other was, I will probably butcher these numbers, but I'll say them anyways. I think Amazon at the time I joined was probably just around 25 billion and was about 250 billion when I left.
Wow.
And so to be a part of an organization at that scale, there's a reason I talk about holding onto the tail of a rocket.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But it meant that scale and how to put the infrastructure, the organization in place for not where you are today, but where you want to be tomorrow was an extraordinary lesson in thinking about organizational structures, operating principles, mechanisms to make the business successful. And so there was a tremendous amount of challenge that came with that growth that was insanely exciting and, you know, really introduced some of these practices and concepts to me around what it means to scale as a leader, what it means to scale an organization to support the needs of the business tomorrow, not just yesterday or today. And so those became really foundational concepts that I think have really influenced my leadership style, kind of my orientation and decisioning, and has had a pretty powerful effect on who I am as a leader today.
You left this job to go, as I said before, to Bergdorf Goodman, which is truly a legacy brand. You know, it's
absolutely,
it sits at the bottom of Central Park. You know, it's really the most iconic building. It's in so many movies and just even in the cultural language of New York City. I mean, a lot of times you'll see renderings of the city and there's Bergdorf, you know, just sitting there. What was it like for you to go from a place that was, you felt like you were holding onto the end of a rocket, to a company that's been around forever, and I'm sure growth is something that they have their eye on? I mean, I was reading through your bio, and February 2020 was when you launched BG.com,
right? Yes, and I don't know if that was just impeccable timing. Or
I mean, I was reading that, and I kept looking back and thinking to myself, oh my gosh. Yeah. But then having to lead through COVID, I mean, you've had challenges there too.
Yeah.
What made you take that leap?
So I remember the recruiter that called me about it sort of teasing me that she'd been calling me for 9 years, and it's the first call that I had really taken.
And you probably nodded.
Yes, she was not wrong. But I think there were a handful of things that influenced that for me. I had had a great experience working for the company the first time. And so those things stick with you, how leaders treated you, what that experience and culture were like. And there was something very familial about the way the Bergdorf culture was. I saw this opportunity that I felt like was really fascinating to take a beloved brand and think about threading the needle of how do I not break something that has this sort of richly steeped history. To your point, it is an iconic sort of part of the fabric of New York store.
Yeah.
And how do you unlock what it means to modernize that in a way that stays true to those roots? And so, you know, I mentioned that right brain, left brain sort of gets me out of bed in the morning. And so the exercise of saying, I believe there is opportunity to grow this business through taking all the good parts of that rich history and finding the places where modernizing those can change the curve of the business and really set the organization up. We're nearing our 125th anniversary.
Oh my gosh.
So as a steward of that, you say, well, how do I make sure the role I play is setting us up for the next 125? And there's something
that honoring the past as well.
Absolutely. And there's something weighty about that and also incredibly exciting in the process.
Well, it's so funny because I can see in your face how much you love it. And I know just from speaking to you over time, how much you've loved this role and have relished in this role. Yeah. At what point did you take over the new part of your role, which is dealing with technology for the Neiman Marcus Group?
So it's been about a year. So not all that long ago that I added that. And I've been with the company for about 6 years now. And I had spent quite a bit of time working across with that team. And it's an incredible part of the organization. It's, you know, it's another part that actually has very interesting challenges around how do you take legacy technology? Because I don't know that this is a commonly known thing, but Neiman's was actually very early in launching their website. I think they launched in either 99 or 2000. So really early days of going into that, had a large catalog business at the time. And so when you have legacy systems, in some ways today, starting an online business today, in many ways, from a technology perspective, is way easier than I have technology where I'm still dealing with legacy systems that may be homegrown or deeply integrated into our experience. And so while the group had made a lot of investments in technology over the years, when you have those legacy components, there's different sort of challenges that you face in managing that. And I think both between the digital experience that I came into this role with, as well as seeing an opportunity to more deeply embed business choices and technology kind of together, it's really what made this sort of come to fruition, was an opportunity to sort of play a part in the connective tissue between those two things.
Well, it's been amazing to watch. And I've loved hearing this story of how you ultimately came back to where you started in New York City. I always love a good fashion story in New York City. Where can we find you? Where can we follow your progress? What comes next?
Oh, I have no idea of what's next. I feel very passionate about where I am today. And I think for me, it's what does it mean to keep sort of evolving the business that we're running? I remember someone saying this idea of like, these are legacy roles. These are things where you can say, what's the imprint that I can make on this organization? And, you know, I feel like there's plenty of room for me to still influence that in where I am. And it's around the world of fashion in New York. It holds a very special place in that. And so it feels like a total honor and a joy to get to have that be part of my everyday.
Well, I know that you are going to inspire so many people with
very
your words and this podcast. I've loved hearing about your evolution in your jobs, your multiple career changes, but how this path ultimately is the path that you've set. Mm-hmm. At the end of this podcast, I like to ask our listeners to either think about a question or think about something that they can do and DM us both. And one thing I would say is, what are you doing to be the architect of your own life? I think Darcy has certainly shown herself to do that, to be very intentional about the choices that she makes and then to go in with full abandon. So I hope that whatever you're doing in your life, you will do the same. I thank you all so much for listening and tuning in week after week. Darcy, thank you for being here on this cold, rainy day. Thank you to Joe, my amazing producer. Thank you to Newsstand Studios and Tishman Speyer for letting us do this in this iconic building. I'm Lydia Finette. This is Claim Your Confidence. I can't wait to be with you again next Tuesday. Have a great week.